NPR's Throughline podcast sort of feels like stepping into a time machine. Each episode, our Peabody Award-winning show travels beyond the headlines to answer the question, how did we get here? Listen to one of Apple's favorite podcasts of 2024 by searching for Throughline on Apple Podcasts or on your favorite podcast app.
When global markets tumble, investors rush to buy gold. Does its reputation as a safe investment really hold up?
Gold is quite a volatile investment. The ups and the downs are equivalent to the S&P 500.
I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll hear about a potential ceasefire between Turkey and Kurdish militants. And in Peru, new legislation is rattling civil society groups.
If a group of citizens have a problem with their human rights being violated by an entity from the state, nobody will be able to help them.
People in Norway are hanging their heads in shame as Norwegian ski jumpers are disqualified from a big event.
We like to think of ourselves as fair play sports persons, so this is a big blow to our self-image.
Those stories and more today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for joining us today. There's something of a global gold rush going on. One troy ounce of gold broke the $3,000 mark today. That's an all-time record.
In turbulent economic times, gold is seen as an investor's safe haven. To find out why demand for gold is on the rise, I spoke earlier with Campbell Harvey. He's a professor of finance at Duke University.
So gold is perceived as a very safe collateral. So this is consistent with the idea that China and some other countries want to hedge. They don't want to be so dependent upon the US dollar. And when they're adding to their gold stocks, given the limited production of gold every year, that increased demand is providing a pressure that increases the price of gold. The second factor, as you mentioned, is the heightened uncertainty in the world right now. Given we don't really know where the U.S. administration is going, given the uncertainty about the economy, potential inflation in the future, and other things like tariff policy, that gold is generally perceived as a safe haven investment.
Right. I was going to ask you, it's always seen as a safe investment, but how true is that?
Many people don't realize that the gold is quite a volatile investment. So the volatility, the ups and the downs, are equivalent to the S&P 500. So this is safe haven in quotations because it doesn't always work. Indeed, we saw it not working in March 2020, where we had the COVID scare and we saw the stock market plummet. The price of Bitcoin dropped by 55% and gold lost 20%. So that was a situation where it really wasn't a safe haven. So when you've got an asset like gold that's so volatile, sometimes it will fail to fulfill its role as a safe haven.
So I really want to spend some time talking about logistics here, because gold obviously is a physical thing. It's not like stocks or bonds that get traded, you know, over the internet. What does gold trading actually look like when there is this high demand for gold? What actually happens?
Well, there's various different ways to look at this. Number one, there's not that much gold that's produced every year. So over the last year, only 3,300 metric tons were produced.
So like mined.
Yeah, exactly. And 70% of that gold goes to jewelry and about 5% to technology. And then there's central banks that are accumulating the gold, and then there's investment. So the ETFs, you mentioned the physical gold, the ETFs have made it a lot easier for regular investors to hold gold.
An ETF, an exchange-traded fund, so just like we think of stocks and bonds?
Exactly. So you might have an ETF that represents the S&P 500, and then you might have an ETF that represents gold.
But there are still people who want the gold bullion, for example, in their safes at home. So what happens when some gold does actually have to move around the world when demand increases in a specific place?
So there are stores that actually sell the bullion. And again, I would caution investors on this because when you buy it, it seems like a good deal. But when you sell it, it's very difficult. So it's not like you can return it to the store. So it's much easier to deal with an ETF. In terms of the gold moving around the world, so we've got the major gold vaults in London, in New York, and Fort Knox. So in terms of the financialization, gold moves all the time. So people borrow gold, and gold is routinely transported from London across to, let's say, the New York Fed, or even Fort Knox.
And do you just put a bunch of gold on a plane and fly it on over?
Yeah, exactly. And I think there is also tariff risk. So some of the gold holdings are being repatriated to the U.S. to reduce the risk that some sort of tariff would be slapped on gold that is being repatriated from Europe.
Interesting. If things calm down and become less uncertain, if maybe this fear of tariffs subsides, what does that mean for gold traders and all those gold bars we've been talking about that get shipped all around the globe?
So if there is this relation between gold and a safe haven, and when things calm down, it's reasonable to expect that the demand for the safe haven asset could decrease, and that could lead to the price of gold going down. However, let's be careful here because gold is a very volatile asset. So it might go down, but it might go up also because of volatility.
Campbell Harvey is a professor of finance at Duke University.
In London, there's a wall that stretches along the River Thames that has become something of a pilgrimage site. On it are more than 240,000 hand-painted hearts, each representing a person in the UK who died of COVID. This past Sunday, family members and locals gathered at the wall for a day of reflection to mark 5 years since the outbreak of the pandemic. They passed 3,000 photographs of people who died. Reporter Leah Hornack visited the National COVID Memorial Wall last October and found a piece of art that's still very much a work in progress.
Like every one of the volunteers working here down by the River Thames, Lorelei King's fingers are stained with red paint.
You can't really call yourself a volunteer at the Memorial Wall unless every item of clothing you own has a dab of red paint on it somewhere.
It's a warm fall day, and we're standing on a walkway overlooking the river. Directly opposite us, across the water, are Britain's Houses of Parliament and the golden clock tower of Big Ben. This is the very centre of the city, a living tourist postcard.
It's very peaceful here. It's very beautiful.
But every week, when Lorelei and the other volunteers gather here with their brushes and pots of red paint, they face away from the clock tower and the Parliament, towards a grey stone wall that runs along the river, painting and repainting.
It was just first going to be a heart for each person who died from COVID in this country. And then gradually it became something else, and then it kind of grew.
And grew. Now, when you look along the riverside, hand-sized red-painted hearts fill every inch of the wall, tailing off to the horizon in a blur, a red and pink wave of grief. This is the COVID Memorial Wall.
I think if you see a statistic or a number, it's very easy to say, oh, yeah, quarter of a million. If you see a quarter of a million hearts, it's going to affect you. You're going to get it.
Lorelei and the volunteers meet here every Friday to paint in all weathers. The wall's now so long that as soon as a new set of hearts are painted on, old hearts are fading and need renewing.
It was never intended to be permanent. In fact, it is technically criminal damage to put the hearts on the wall.
But now, no one would dare scrub the wall clear. And then there are the dedications. Originally, each painted heart was intended to represent a number, with no name or person attached. But then people began contacting the volunteers with requests for personal messages written on individual hearts.
Many people who don't have a grave, for example, or a gravestone for their loved one, they'll have a heart on the wall, and they feel that they're not alone. Their loved one is with others.
When I look closer at the wall now, Many of the hearts are crammed with tiny handwritten messages to lost parents, siblings, wives, husbands, and loved ones. And when those fade, the volunteers repaint them too.
And that just gives incredible meaning to my life. I feel like I have purpose. Vince used to be my purpose.
Vince Marzello was Lorelei's husband. He has a dedicated heart on the wall too. To join the Wall Volunteers team, there's only one condition. You must have lost someone to COVID.
I lost Vince very early in the pandemic, on March 31st of 2020.
He had early onset Alzheimer's and was in a care facility. During lockdown, access for relatives was almost impossible.
I was staying away to keep him safe, and I regret that now. And I just got a phone call that he had died. They came in hazmat suits to take him away, like he was nuclear waste. And the thing when you're not with your loved one, when I wasn't with Vince when he died, there's no do-overs. I cannot get that moment back. That will never go away. And I'm still not over it, as you can see. What I feel is rage.
And that feeling of rage is why the volunteers picked this wall, one which faces the politicians.
It was important to us that they see this wall, they get this message. That's why the hearts are red, red reeds across the river. The location of this wall is not a mistake.
As we're talking, two women in their 40s walk up to Lorelei. Hilary Linus is from Glasgow, Scotland, and her friend Alwyn Fisher is from Nottingham in the Midlands of England, both far from London. And both visit here every year to see the handwritten dedication to each of their parents.
Yeah, I might get a bit tearful, so I apologise.
Alwyn offers to read hers first. Careful, small black handwriting on a deep red heart.
Charles Fisher, born on the 24th of May 1953, and he passed away on the 30th of October 2020. And it just says, love you lots, Dad, because I always used to say that to him.
Then Hilary.
Mine just says Margaret Glenn Linus, which is my mum's name, and it's from myself, Hilary, and Hugh, who's my dad. And at the top it just says, love you then well, which is a strange thing, but my mum and I, for some reason, that was our wee thing we said to each other at the end of every call, would say, love you then well. So that's on there as well. Every name on here, every name is a person that was loved. And every name represents a family. My mum caught COVID in hospital, and that's what you, sorry, that's what you need to remember, that every name here is a person that somebody loved. So yes, it is special.
Visiting here is a ritual for both of them. At the end of each Friday session, Lorelei and the other volunteers pack up their paints and brushes, take off their memorial wall jackets, and catch the bus or underground back to their real lives.
I think the message of the wall is that actions have consequences. Lack of action has consequences. And those consequences are represented on this wall. And I hope for the future it will inspire people to take steps to mitigate the horror of something like this happening again.
For The World, Leo Hornack, London.
It's a party today in Hindu communities around the world. People in the streets of Ahmedabad, India here celebrating Holi with an explosion of color.
People cover each other in vibrant powders of every hue until just about everyone is smeared from head to toe in streaks of orange, purple, yellow, and blue. Children even throw water balloons and spray squirt guns to add to the chaos.
Holi honors divine love and the arrival of spring, a time of rebirth and rejuvenation. It's a national holiday in India, with millions celebrating across South Asia and throughout the world. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You may recall this story from about 2 years ago.
Ukraine and Russia are accusing each other of blowing up a major dam, sparking warnings of severe flooding in Russian-controlled territory.
40,000 people may need to be evacuated. That's according to officials. That's the latest number. 80 towns and villages impacted.
We learned later that Russian forces in Ukraine were responsible for destroying the Kakhovka Dam. Tens of thousands of people were driven from their homes and more than 50 people were killed. A new study reveals some of the long-term damage to the environment and a looming threat. Heavy metals in a reservoir bed that was exposed when the burst dam released its waters. Alexandra Shumilova is with the Leibniz Institute in Berlin. She's one of the authors of the new study out this week in the journal Science. We spoke earlier today about what her team found in the sediment exposed when the Kakhovka Dam was destroyed.
One of the most important outcomes of our study is that we show that most of the sediments that were accumulated in this reservoir were actually not released from the reservoir, but remained there.
Okay.
And they contain high concentration of toxic heavy metal, which presently become exposed and can pose negative effects on the environment and human health.
So we're talking about the reservoir that dried out when this Kakhovka Dam burst. There were lots of heavy metals in the sediment there, you're saying, and mostly they are still there in this reservoir bed that's now dry. Why is that a problem?
Presently, this sediments became exposed. And what happens with this area of the former reservoir? It periodically flooded due to seasonal floods.
It periodically floods seasonally?
Yes, when there is a seasonal flood, like snow is melting, the water is coming to that area. People which are living nearby can use this water and also can be exposed to pollutants.
So when these sediments are flooded, these heavy metals can be stirred up, can be captured by the water and brought downstream, which you're saying can impact vegetation, it can impact drinking water quality?
Yes.
So what kinds of heavy metals did you find and what impact do they have on human health if they're consumed?
Heavy metals which are contained there are mostly lead, nickel, cadmium, and these heavy metals are very toxic. They can have effect on various systems of human body, including endocrine system, reproductive system. It can also lead to cancer.
And brain damage and liver damage, too, some of those metals.
Yes, so the consequences can be very serious and long-lasting.
The quantity of this sediment and the heavy metals in them were surprising. Just how much are we talking about here?
This accumulated sediments contain around 86,000 tons of heavy metals.
86,000 tons. Over how large of an area?
So when we talk about the area of the reservoir, it was approximately 80% of the area of such country as Luxembourg.
Oh, wow. So almost the size of Luxembourg, this reservoir. So I remember back when this dam burst in 2023, we didn't have much information for a long time about what the real environmental impact was because the dam and so much of the impacted land was in Russian-held territory. How did you actually carry out this study, given those security concerns?
We tried to apply different kinds of remote sensing. Also, we have information from field surveys which were conducted before the start of the war and some samples from some monitoring station located downstream.
So you said it's not clear yet what impact this is having on human health and vegetation and wildlife because you can't access these areas to study them. Do you have a sense of when we might know more?
Presently, the area of this reservoir, it's a borderland between territories that are under Ukrainian control and territories under Russian control. So to do field experiments, we definitely need to wait until the end of the war.
So still, there'll be a lot of unanswered questions until the war ends.
For sure.
Alexandra Shumilova is a river scientist with the Leibniz Institute in Berlin.
In France, people are raising their glass to a bill that's working its way through Parliament. It would make it easier to open cafes and bars in remote villages. Some 20,000 French hamlets are essentially barless. And no bar means no place to gather, gossip, and sip a beer or traditional pastis. The Bring Bars Back proposal is meant to breathe more life into rural France. The World's Gerry Haddon took a swing through the country's least populated region, the Eastern Pyrenees, asking the question, where can a guy get a drink around here?
I'm in a mountain hamlet called Jujol, population 55. It's basically a small cluster of stone houses. hardly a place you'd find a Hard Rock Cafe, or, it turns out, any cafe.
Bonjour, madame.
Excuse me, I ask resident Nathalie Domé. She's out trimming the hedge in front of her cottage. Is there a cafe in town to wet my whistle?
Alors, y a rien du tout.
A drink, she says. You've got zero options. No cafe, no bar, no bistro. Nathalie's husband, Pierre, joins us.
Ah oui, oui, tout à fait. Oui, 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 on en parle des fois entre nous.
Of course, it'd be great if we had some place to get together, he says. We talk about it from time to time. If you want to have a drink in a public place, he says, you need to drive down the winding mountain road 3 miles to a village below. It's complicated, he says. You need a designated driver.
Qui veut du coca?
One who sticks to soft drinks, Nathalie says. French lawmaker Guillaume Casparion says a bar or bistro in places like this could spark a modest little renaissance, maybe even convince young people not to leave. But he told French radio recently, France's bureaucracy makes it just about impossible to open a place that serves alcohol. Right now, it's illegal to hand out new liquor licenses in France, he said, citing a law that dates back to 1941. The only way to get a license is to wait until someone who has one in your area wants to sell it. It can take a long time, he says, if it happens at all, and can cost tens of thousands of dollars. Casparion's just gotten a bill through the lower house of France's parliament that would allow new liquor licenses in villages with less than 3,500 residents. He's been touring around the countryside, recording interviews in places with bars to underscore what a difference that can make. One bar owner tells him, people come in for the warmth of human company. Contrast that with the silence on the empty streets of Jujol, and you get Casparion's point. But just as I'm leaving the supposedly dry mountain village, neighbor Nathalie Domé says there might be a place where you can buy a beer. She tells me about Alain, a retired guy who lives at the end of the road in the very last house.
Bonjour. C'est la maison où on peut acheter.
The gray-bearded Alain is easy to find. When I tell him what I'm after, he leads me into his garage and cuts open a cardboard box. Inside, bottles of an artisanal beer he says he's allowed to sell. His price, around $3 a pop.
Ta-da. Cheers.
Cheers.
Salut.
A bon weekend, ça va être 10.
On a busy weekend, Alain says, I can sell up to 10 of these. It's a pretty small operation. So small, he can't let his clients imbibe on his property. That'd require that hard-to-get liquor license. So he tells me what he tells everyone, with a fresh brew in their hand, but nowhere to go.
His recommendation was to come sit in front of town hall and drink my beer. That's a first.
And maybe a last, if France does allow for new liquor licenses in towns like this. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon, Jujol, France.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Turkey and the militant group the Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, might be moving toward a ceasefire. And that would be a big deal because they've been locked in a deadly conflict for more than 40 years. The PKK operates not only in Turkey, but in northern Iraq and Syria as well. The World's Duri Buscarin traveled to Diyarbakir, a majority Kurdish city in southeastern Turkey, to speak with people there about the impact of a possible ceasefire.
Let me show you something.
To Ramazan Tunç, the stones of Sur tell a story.
These are the places of the bullets. There were barricades and trenches just behind here.
We walk through the maze of alleyways in the historic center of Diyarbakir. Here, low doors force you to bow your head to your host before stepping into spacious courtyards. Tunç points out how, at eye level, the brickwork changes.
These are the rocks that shape the old style. No, these are later on added to this.
At the height of the PKK insurgency in the 1990s, the Turkish army burned villages in the Kurdish countryside. Families who lost their homes moved here, to Sur, where their relatives took them in, adding extra stories on top of their existing houses. Their homes grew taller, stretching up over the windy streets.
This made the city to be like a labyrinth. But the streets are very well connected.
If you know where you're going. Perhaps this is why the PKK entrenched themselves in Sur when peace talks with the Turkish government last broke down in 2015. This part of the city is surrounded by tall, fortified walls, first built by the Romans, perched on a hilltop overlooking the green banks of the Tigris River. For 3 months, Turkish military tanks occupied the other side of Sur, placing the city under a curfew. Nearly half of Sur was destroyed in the fighting between Turkey and the PKK. Human rights groups say at least 200 people died.
There was no electricity, no water, and it is a tactic of war, actually.
The Turkish government rebuilt Sur.
But the houses that had been built is something like jails, something like that is not belong to Diyarbakir.
The avenues are wide enough to accommodate military equipment. Apartment buildings are white and boxy, with thin walls and broken windows. They don't appear to have anyone living in them yet.
They are aiming to destroy memories, and very few generations will remember what's happened.
As the PKK retreated to its strongholds in the mountains of northern Iraq, the Turkish government followed, conducting airstrikes in the Kandil Mountains. In northeastern Syria, PKK affiliates joined a U.S.-backed coalition known as the Syrian Democratic Forces. Turkey attacked them, too. Turkish officials maintain that these cross-border airstrikes are necessary to protect Turkey. In a press briefing shortly after the PKK said it would accept a ceasefire, National Defense Ministry spokesperson Zeki Aktürk made it clear that the Turkish government had no intention of stopping. He announced that strikes had killed 26 militants in Iraq and Syria over the past week.
Terörle mücadelesini tek bir terörist kalmayıncaya kadar azim ve kararlılıkla sürdürecektir.
We will not stop until every single terrorist is eliminated, Aktürk said.
The people are adapted to it because it's become a part of their day.
Aras Yusuf, a researcher for the Kurdish Peace Institute, is based in the Syrian border city of Qamishlo. Yusuf says many people there welcomed the PKK's call for a ceasefire with the Turkish government.
So if both reach to an agreement, Turkey will have no more pretexts to continue shelling Kurdish areas in Syria.
Sonar Choptai, an analyst at the Washington Institute, says U.S. military leaders likely leaned heavily on Kurdish militias in Syria to accept Turkey's conditions for a ceasefire, possibly warning that the U.S. would soon withdraw military support.
I think certain Kurds know that once the United States exits, they're going to be facing Turkey or Damascus.
Earlier this week, the Kurdish coalition inked a deal to join Syria's fledgling central government. In many ways, Choptai says, the PKK's leaders have been forced into a position where they have no more room to negotiate.
For this leadership to agree to disband the PKK would be the equivalent of saying, I have thrown my life away for nothing.
In the back room of an old cafe, a former PKK fighter asks not to use his full name. He joined the insurgency at the age of 16, he says, after three of his uncles were tortured in prison. The year was
1992.
In the 90s, there was a need for an armed conflict, he says, but now it's changing. The PKK is no longer seeking its own territory, but political and cultural rights for Kurdish people in Turkey, he says. This former fighter says the PKK's call for a ceasefire did not surprise him, because he believes the insurgency has run its course. Now it's time for a political solution. The goal is to democratize the country and pressure the state to recognize the existence of Kurds, he says. What remains to be seen is how the Turkish government will respond. For the world, I'm Derya Buskarian, Diyarbakir, Eastern Turkey.
Oslo is hosting a ski jumping World Cup event this weekend, but the Norwegian team is missing some of its star members.
Great flight, super technique. Has he got the landing? He's got the distance. Lindvik for Norway.
That's Marius Lindvik winning gold at the 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing. But this week, he and other members of Norway's ski jumping team were banned from competing because they're suspected of modifying their ski jumping suits. They deny the accusation, but the International Ski and Snowboard Federation is investigating. Sigmund Lolland is a professor of sports philosophy and sport and ethics at the Norwegian School of Sport Sciences in Oslo. He says that members of Norway's ski jumping team were caught red-handed.
There was actually a video. A competitor has videotaped the Norwegian support system in the middle of the night, putting seams into the jumping suits of the jumpers. These stitches are supposed to make the suit less flexible, meaning that the suit gives a better lift and you can fly longer in the air.
And as I understand it, these were sort of stitches and seams added in the crotch of these jumping uniforms.
Right.
Is the idea that the heavier thread gave a little bit more gravity and a little more weight to the suits, and that's why they might be able to go further?
Well, not necessarily gravity, but area-wise, it becomes bigger in the air, so you can float more or less like a wingsuit principle. When you see the wingsuits, you can fly through the air. So when you expand the area of the suit, floating on the air, it gives an added length to the jump.
And I hope our listeners can envision this if you've ever watched ski jumping on TV. That famous pose of ski jumpers, they take off from the jump and they kind of lean forward and their skis are turning upwards. They're kind of flying.
That's right. It's an amazing sport, and it's about flying, and it's also about timing the exact moment at the edge of the jump. That's where everything happens. That is when the jumper enters into the flying position. And if you have a big suit, you fly longer, basically. That's why there are rules. The suits are individually adapted to your body shape. And if it's oversized, so to speak, you cheat.
Now, who is actually accused of this? The athletes themselves, the coaches, a combination?
Still unclear. The official version now is that the athletes didn't know about this final manipulation just before the competition. And the support system, the coach, the assistant coach, and the person who is an expert on designing the suits, they're all fired. So it's bad.
Now, have the coaches themselves, those accused of this, have they said, yep, we did it, or are they denying it?
They have said, we did it. They have admitted manipulating the suits, and they have admitted the cheating.
This is a big deal for Norway. I mean, Norway, they're the best, really, in the Nordic sports, as they are called, the Nordic sports. How is the Norwegian public responding?
It's not just a ski jumping community. All Norwegian ski-interested public is actually shocked. Norwegian elite sport is part of the main sport organizations, including all grassroots sport, children's sport, youth sport. It's all in one big organization, and the work with attitudes, values, fair play is quite prominent in the organization, and we like to think of ourselves as fair play sports persons. So this is a big blow to our self-image, specifically in skiing, of course.
Now, we're less than a year away from another Winter Olympics. What kind of tone does this set for Norway and for their ski jumping prospects?
This is part of a bigger story, of course. We have to clean up our own mess now in Norway, but it's not uncommon in ski jumping to manipulate equipment, to manipulate suits, to manipulate the angle of the bindings. Just a few millimeters adjustments can give you meters in the jumping hill in the competition. So the sport actually has trouble. And the FIS, the International Skiing Federation, is not just looking at the Norwegian case these days. There will be a broader run-through of the whole system, how the rules are designed and how the rules and the controls are implemented in practice. So this is, on the Norwegian side, a bad part of a much bigger story, which is actually a crisis in the sport of ski jumping.
Sigmund Lolland is a professor of sports philosophy and ethics at the Norwegian School of Sport Sciences in Oslo. And now let's catch you up on a few things you might have missed.
In Cambodia, the torso of a Buddha statue was found in the Angkor Wat temple complex. Archaeologists were especially excited because it matches a head that was found at the same site back in the 1920s. The statue is thought to be 800 or 900 years old, and now it's only missing its right hand. Cambodia's National Museum hopes to recover that, too, so it can display a fully restored piece of history.
In Egypt this week, strongman Ashraf Maroos was recognized by Guinness World Records for setting new records in three categories. And they are the fastest 100-meter locomotive pull, the heaviest locomotive pull, and the heaviest locomotive pull using his teeth. The locomotive in question weighed a whopping 279 tons.
And finally, Volkswagen hit record sales in 2024 for a product that has nothing to do with cars. It's sausage. The VW Currywurst is a staple at the company's cafeterias and in stores nearby. A former German chancellor once called it the power bar of the skilled factory worker. More than 8 million of them were sold last year.
And that's a few things you might have missed.
Rising sea levels are a threat to coastal regions all over, but the situation is especially dire for certain places. And few stand out more than the South Pacific island nation of Tuvalu.
As our land disappears, we have no choice but to become the world's first digital nation.
Simon Kofi, a politician from Tuvalu, appearing there in a government-produced video from 2022, he was announcing that Tuvalu was creating a clone of itself in the metaverse. This is part of the effort to save the island's culture as global warming carves away at its actual landmass.
Piece by piece, we'll preserve our country, provide solace to our people, and remind our children and our grandchildren what our home once was.
The digital clone would survive after sea levels have overtaken Tuvalu. But as Kathleen Schuster reports from our partners, DW, Deutsche Welle, people in Tuvalu are deeply connected to the land, and they aren't giving it up yet.
This intimate bond with the island is exactly what Bernard Kato Ewikia has with his home. Kato, as he prefers to be called, is a 28-year-old climate activist. As a kid, one of his favorite places on Tuvalu was a beach where he played rugby with his friends.
There is the sea. There is a sand. We can rough each other up without getting hurt because sand is soft.
In his teens, Kato's family moved to Fiji. He remembers returning home after a few years and asking his friends if they wanted to play.
And then they were like, oh, but we can't go to that beach again. They told me that, my brother, that beach is gone.
One solution they've tried on Tuvalu are seawalls, but none have stood up against cyclones and the erosion from rising water. So instead, Tuvalu's attempting to literally raise itself further above the ocean. In 2017, it launched a land reclamation project. The Tuvalu Coastal Adaptation Project, TCAP for short, is building new land that would remain above sea levels beyond the end of the century and act as a buffer from storms. The design involves scanning the shoreline and then dredging sand from Tuvalu's deeper surrounding waters to fill large geotextile bags on the reclamation area. Last year, the project finished building along Tuvalu's main island, where the capital is located. The new land is 730 meters long, 100 meters wide, and, importantly, 6 meters high, making it Tuvalu's highest and safest point. Kato thinks it's going to really help with sea level rise.
And you know what's nice about it? The beach that I used to play that disappeared is there. It's in the reclamation land. Yeah, but the sad thing about it, we can't play because the government owns it now. But hey, I can tell my children that I play rugby there at the beach. I'm really excited to go back and walk on that new land.
This reassurance hasn't come cheap. The new land cost nearly $40 million, with Tuvalu contributing just under $3 million, and the Green Climate Fund, the world's largest climate fund, providing the rest. But locals have been encouraged already by seeing the land put to the test. Back in February of 2024, Tuvalu had large king tides that crashed across the main island where the capital is located, cutting off roads. But the TCAP land remained untouched.
So it has now normalized land reclamation in the Pacific as a way of adapting to sea level rise and to climate change.
That's Liam Saddington, a political and environmental geographer at Cambridge University. He says land reclamation in Tuvalu is not only a landmark project, it also gives them important leverage in international climate negotiations.
So that when they are negotiating and, you know, the state on the other side of the table says, well, you're asking me to do this with decarbonising or raise this amount of funding, what are you doing? Tuvalu can say, look at the sheer scale of what we are having to undertake to remain in situ.
The land reclamation project challenges this image of Tuvalu as just a sinking island. For Caddo, that's really important.
Instead of you putting, you know, as like a sinking island, how about you put us, you know, as a rising nation for the future? I'm here because I'm fighting for my country not to disappear, but not for you to tell me that my country is disappearing.
Caddo says the sinking island image denies Tuvaluans their agency and resilience and portrays them as passive victims instead. Some argue it even risks creating a self-fulfilling prophecy, because if an island is destined to sink, why would donors invest in saving it? Even though the land reclamation project and the digital twin might at first seem like conflicting approaches, they are both part of the government's climate strategy, almost like a plan A and plan B. And they're both examples of Tuvalu taking its fate into its own hands. As one academic put it, even a dystopian future should be a Tuvaluan one.
That's Kathleen Schuster from our partners at DW, Deutsche Welle. This story is an excerpt from a much bigger report about Tuvalu and climate change. Hear the full episode on the DW podcast, Living Planet.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Civil society groups in Peru say there's a new threat to human rights in the country. Lawmakers there just passed a bill that would prohibit non-government organizations or NGOs to file lawsuits against the state. That includes allegations of human rights abuses. Julio Urunaga is the Peru director for the nonprofit Environmental Investigation Agency. She explained the law this way.
One of the most important parts is that from now on, all civil society organizations that receive any kind of support will have to submit their annual action plan to the government to be pre-approved, identifying not only the general objectives, but like exactly what things you're going to do, when, how, with whom. We don't know how long it will take to be approved. Also, what are going to be the conditions, what will be approved, what not, what if they don't like the actions? Will they forbid the organizations to conduct those actions? I mean, it's censorship, right? I mean, in addition to this, we also have that none of these organizations will be able to support in any way or advise in any way for any legal or administrative actions against the government, against the state. So if a group of citizens have a problem with their human rights being violated by an entity from the state, nobody will be able to help them.
Will the government, under this bill, if it's passed, will they have to approve all expenditures by an NGO? Anything the NGO wants to do, the government will have to approve of it? Or is it just cases against the government around human rights issues?
No, no, no. Everything, all the action plans, all the activities. And this exposes the people in the field that are actually trying to take actions to protect their land, to protect their rights, to protect their environment, to protect their children. And they are going to be exposed before they can take action, while they're being trained, while they're trying to get organized, right? And so the people, either government or private actors, that they're going to plan to take action to defend themselves from, are going to know that they're preparing. This is exposing them to more attacks and threats.
What's the larger political context to this bill? I mean, have there been other similar efforts like this to restrict civil society in Peru?
So this is what's happening right now. I mean, Peru has been defined as not very clearly a democracy anymore, right? I mean, the Congress, the executive, they're on the same line, and they have been weakening the democracy and the regulations in the country to fight organized crime, to protect the environment, to protect human rights. Peru is one of the countries with largest amount of indigenous environmental defenders being murdered in the last few years. None of these cases have anybody in prison at the moment, because the legal cases take forever, and the lawyers and the law support that the NGOs can provide is very limited.
What has the reaction been in Peru to this bill?
Well, I think it is divided. I mean, civil society in general are concerned. But then there's also a small sector, the one that is buying this excuse or this justification from the Congress, that claims that this is to increase transparency, which is a total fake. And there are actually official investigations by the assets laundering authorities in Peru that have showed that there's no problem, or there's a minimum problem with the non-for-profit sector in terms of assets laundering or embezzlement. This is a way from the government to stop the little ways in which the citizens could still organize and contest the abuses and the corruption from the government. This was the last resistance, and it's been destroyed.
Julia Urunaga is the Peru director for the Environmental Investigation Agency.
It's the middle of March, and a lot of people are getting ready to celebrate the legacy of a particular patron saint, but it is not Saint Patrick. There's another holiday coming up for a lesser-known character. Saint Urho and his mythical origins are quite the tale, which the world's Bianca Hillier has for us.
For decades now, people in Finland have gathered to celebrate Saint Urho. There's live music. A fierce game of tug of war. And, of course, a parade. But before we go any further, let's get a couple of things straight. This celebration is not in Finland, the country. It's in Finland, Minnesota. And the honorary man in question, Saint Urho, isn't actually real. Arlene Konzelman is planning the 50th celebration of this fictional saint.
Well, it is a made-up story, of course.
A made-up story created in Minnesota. The legend goes like this.
Saint Urho drove all of the grasshoppers out of Finland and saved the wine crop.
Gary Kaunonen grew up north of Minneapolis and has Finnish heritage. He says, yep, the tale centers around protecting wine. And in case you're wondering, no, there wasn't really a wine crop in Finland. That's another make-believe detail, says Elaine Kumpula, Finland's honorary consul in the southern half of Minnesota.
Really, there weren't vineyards in Finland when they created this back in like the 1950s. There may have been a few, but not many.
Accounts vary, but Kaunonen says the holiday was probably started by a Finnish-American man named Richard Mattson in 1956.
And that just happened to be when Urho Kekkonen was the president of Finland. So that is probably where the saint name came from.
As for why a Minnesotan invented this holiday, well, that's up for debate, too. Some say Mattson wanted to get a leg up on his Irish friends by celebrating St. Urho one day before St. Patrick. Others say he just wanted an excuse to start the St. Patrick's Day drinking earlier. Kumpula reckons that it was just a fun tale to tell.
It's a fun day that can be celebrated any place somebody would like to do it. So eat some pea soup and have a good time.
Pea soup, a traditional Finnish dish. This weekend, St. Urho's Day events will take place across the northern Midwest and southern Ontario. In Finland, the country, though, it's just business as usual. A bartender named Janne answered the phone at St. Urho's pub in Helsinki. It's named after the former president, he says, not the mythical man.
Here in Finland, we don't celebrate St. Urho's Day.
He says staff members do know the story, though, and sometimes bring it up with U.S. visitors who come in for a pint. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. I'm Carol Hills.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. We'll see you right back here on Monday.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Cindy and Dan Lothian, Serena Altschul, Kamrudin Mithani, Jane Johnson, Elizabeth Hansen and Jake Shapiro, and Alyssa and Mike Wilson. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.